Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and on the panel in Mission Control way back on Earth, we have Richard. Thank you, Richard, for coming. And on this evening's The Space Show, we will be remembering Jim Lovell, who went to the moon twice, didn't walk on it though, and we'll be continuing the story we began last week as we remember the life of Jim Lovell. So, let's get into it with a reminder of the song we played at the end of last week, which was about Apollo 1. Let's hear it.
Plucked from the finest of flight schools regaled, from Mitchell, Grand Rapids, and Texas they hailed, Grissom and Chaffee and Ed White unveiled as the ones to fly the Apollo 1 test away. Apollo 1, NASA's away with Apollo 1. Fare thee well, don't stop till it's done. They're testing the crew of Apollo 1. Sputnik surprised us when it flew overhead. Yuri then beat us, it filled us with dread. But Shepard and Glenn and Mercury led to the test of the crew of Apollo 1. Test away, Apollo 1. NASA's away with Apollo 1. Fare thee well, don't stop till it's done. They're testing the crew of Apollo 1. Gemini marched on from Mercury, strategically building technology. All were completed successfully. They're testing the crew of Apollo 1. Test away, Apollo 1. NASA's away with Apollo 1. Fare thee well, don't stop till it's done. They're testing the crew of Apollo 1. The new Saturn V will be finished up soon. We'll use propaganda and Disney cartoons and beat the damn commies with men on the moon. They're testing the crew of Apollo 1. Test away, Apollo 1. NASA's away with Apollo 1. Fare thee well, don't stop till it's done. They're testing the crew of Apollo 1. They are testing the crew of Apollo 1.
And that's where we left the show last week, with the disastrous fire on the launch pad that killed the three astronauts on Apollo 1. Now, around this time, rocket maker Wernher von Braun explained why he and his team at Huntsville, Alabama, believed it was necessary to continue Apollo.
Since the accident, a million words were spoken and a million words were written. Not all of them competent. We know that we have taken on a very challenging program. Or as Bill Allen, the president of Boeing, said that night, this reminds one again that we are not in the business of making shoes. It is our job as engineers to make sure that these risks that are unavoidable are reduced to the bare minimum. Three brave men lost their lives for space flight, and I think we owe it to Gus Grissom, to Ed White, and to Roger Chaffee that we go back and put our program back into gear where it belongs.
According to Jim Lovell, everyone knuckled down and got on with the job of fixing Apollo and aiming to meet President Kennedy's challenge.
That also meant a longer time before anybody's going to fly again. It means a longer time before you're going to fly again. It means a longer time before anybody's going to fly again.
Well, that's right.
Are you worried that maybe somebody's going to say, let's just forget the whole thing?
Well, yeah, if you recall, the fire took place in 1967. we had a commitment made by President Kennedy that we would land a man on the moon and bring him back home safely before the end of the decade. And when the fire occurred in January of 67, and we didn't know really what it was going to do, everybody was really down on the dump saying, holy cow. So I'd have to admire the engineers, the technicians, and the scientists, and everybody here who found out the problem, and the contractor people who finally realized that, hey, let's get a new type of spacecraft. Let's build something that people really can use. And that's what happened.
By the time Apollo 8 came along, you were back up to Mike Collins. Were you convinced then that the capsule was okay?
Oh yeah, I was. I mean, you have to go by faith. You have to believe in what the people are going to hand you. You know, Al Shepard's old joke was, you know, how does it feel to sit on top of something built by the lowest bidder? But the lowest bidder was, you know, pretty expensive. But you have to believe that whole thing, and I did. I was, you know, Mike's backup, and spent a lot of my time up at Boston working on the guidance system.
Where were you when you found out that he had a bad back and couldn't go, and you were going to go?
I don't really recall where I was. I think I'd come back here, and finally they said, you know, I was his backup, so that was the thing, and Mike had this bone spur, and I think he held off as long as he could, but I think his leg was getting numb. And so finally they replaced me, and I went. You know, faith has sort of strange things, because I never expected it to be on Apollo 8. But I have to tell you, that was the high point of my space career.
But if you hadn't been that backup, you might have been on 11.
Yes, I was assigned to 11. I was assigned to 11, but still, I'd prefer 8 to my position on 11.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so we come to late 1968, and Jim Lovell, Frank Bowman, and Bill Anders get a welcome surprise.
8 turns out to be a significant flight once it takes off, but when you're assigned to it, it's still not what it turned out to be, was it?
No, still Earth orbital, and we are going high up. We're going to do 4,000 miles so that we could test the lunar module, the command module, and then come back in at a high rate of speed so that, you know, we could test the heat shield and things like that. It wasn't, and I recall this very vividly, the three of us were out at Downey at North American testing our spacecraft, and Frank got a call to go back to Houston. So Bill and I still stayed out there. We were working out there. And Frank came back again, back to Downey, and said, things have changed. And we said, they said, what? He said, if everything goes all right with Apollo 7, Apollo 8 will go to the moon. I was elated. I thought, man, this is great. I mean, I already spent 2 weeks in space on Gemini 7 with Frank Borman. I didn't want to spend another 11 days or something like that, you know, going around the Earth again. I said, this is fantastic. And on the way back on the T-38, when it was my turn to sit in the back seat, either Bill or Frank were flying, I drew the Apollo 8 insignia, you know, the V-shaped thing with the Earth and Moon. So
that happened because of Cold War considerations, did it not?
Oh, yeah. Well, two things occurred. The lunar module wasn't ready. And the lunar module was supposed to go up there, you know, and be tested out. And also, as you probably know and as well know now, we had intelligence information that that the Russians were going to put people around the moon. They were really attempting to land people on the moon.
We were discussing Apollo 8 and the politics behind Apollo 8. The Russians are going to try to land on the moon, and Trump... everything America has done.
Actually, the Russians, believe it or not, were interested in lunar landings about the same time we were, and had tried all sorts of things to get there, and were building a huge rocket called the N-1. Built 10 of them, flew 4, none was really successful. Some of them they flew even after we had landed. But they were very persistent people, and they thought that using a different type of a booster called the Proton and a vehicle called Zond, they could fly people, just circumnavigate the moon, just go around it, not land or not even to orbit it. And they were very, you know, close to actually doing that. They had sent a couple spacecraft up, went around the moon. One was not successful. One was partially successful. The next one, the two cosmonauts, and I know them, wanted to go. And then they hesitated back and forth. The hierarchy argued, should we send another unmanned or should we not? And when they did that on this side of the Atlantic, bold leadership at this time They said lunar module's not ready. The command service module, if it proves out in Apollo 7, will be okay. Huntsville thinks the booster could be okay. And so they said, let's send Apollo 8 to the moon. And so that's how it came to pass. And then after we got to the moon, of course, the Russians said we never planned it in the first place.
As a rocket man, and you remind me that you were from the very beginning, as a rocket man, did you think we can do that?
Oh, yes. Looking at the Saturn V and what it could do, and this is, of course, not only the first flight to the moon, but the first time we'd used the Saturn V booster.
At this point in our recounting the life of Jim Lovell, let's ask blind Robert Ward to recount his view of the voyage of Apollo 8.
Come all you good kind people, a story I'll relate. The brave and valiant voyage of the ship Apollo 8. On Christmas Eve of 68, three brave men called the tune and sailed 230,000 miles on a trip around the moon. December 21st it was, I do recall the day. Frank Borman and James Lovell and William Anders Lay strapped tight into their capsule, the time was opportune, and like a bullet fired from a gun, they were off around the moon. Death stared them in their faces, for space might be their tomb, but their courage was undaunted as they sped around the moon. And what they saw they told us of, the craters and the sights, and never in all history had man beheld the like. No man can quite describe it, no, neither late nor soon. It was without a parallel, that trip around the moon. Now Borman, Lovell, and Anders again are safe at home. The heroes of the world today, their voyage it is done. They brought to great day closer, when men will leave the womb and go following their footsteps far out beyond the moon.
The Saturn V stood 111 meters tall and was the largest rocket built by the United States. Rocket builder Wernher von Braun was asked, wouldn't it be quicker to get to the moon using smaller rockets, such as the Saturn I or the Saturn IB? Well, here's his response.
Dr. Kontrowitz, I think I can comment on this. If you remember this figure of 400,000 pounds initial weight needed in orbit to put a crew of three men to the moon, you are really talking about something like 100 ICBM launches to put that initial payload together in orbit. And this becomes a logistics problem like flying the Berlin airlift with Piper Cubs. Nobody can say it can't be done. But it is certainly
if
very
that
attractive.
Was the quickest way, if that were the quickest way of doing it, and we had Piper Cubs, should we wait until we develop DC-6s to do it with?
Well, we think within the total framework of time available here, these 9 years or 8 years that we have, I would put my money on the DC-6s.
As if. And so it came to pass that in 1968 December, the Saturn V left the Kennedy Space Center on its third flight. This one was special. For the first time, there were humans aboard, and it was going to propel Apollo 8 towards the moon.
Tell me about the flight. Tell me about how you felt as you approached that moon and knew you were going to go around it.
Well, my first sensation, of course, was not too far from the Earth, because when we turned around, we could actually see the Earth start to shrink. Now, the highest anybody had ever been, I think, had been either, I think it was Apollo or Gemini 11, up about 800 miles or something like that, and back down again. And all of a sudden, you know, we're just going down. And it reminds me of looking, driving in a car, looking out the back window, going inside a tunnel and seeing the tunnel entrance shrink as you go farther into the tunnel, and it was quite a sensation to think about, you know. And you had to pinch yourself, hey, we're really going to the moon. I mean, you know, this is it. I was a navigator, and it turned out that the navigation equipment was perfect. I mean, it was just, you couldn't ask for a better piece of navigation equipment.
Were you guys just riding, or do you have a lot of work to do?
Oh, we had a lot of work to do. I mean, this was the first test of an actual lunar flight. The vehicle had been tested before, but, you know, we were all looking at it. And I did a lot. The navigation was something new for going out there. And we had a TV program when we got to the moon. But then, coming into the moon itself, the last day, our blunt end was towards the moon. And we didn't see it as it got bigger. Going out there, it doesn't grow gradually like this. It stays sort of small for a while. All of a sudden, it gets bigger like this. That's what it appears like anyway. And our blunt end was towards the moon, so we didn't see it as it got bigger. But the ground called up, and the mission control said, now at such and such a time, and they named it right down to the second, you lose communication with us because the moon's gravity will swing around to the far side. Right to the second, there was static in our earphones, no comm. And then, of course, we lit the engine to slow down, and we got into lunar orbit. And this is where we started to look at the moon, you know, and all those nice things we said. And by the way, I'll put everything to rest right now. Coming around, when we saw the Earth coming up, who took that famous Earthrise picture they made into a stamp in 1969? Now, you might get a different view from Borman or from Anders, but I'll have to tell you right now. Now, you think I'm going to say that I took it. Now, but for 25 years, I said that only to keep the things going, to keep us young and happy, keep a little controversy of the game. Actually, I think Anders took the picture. But you have to remember, I was the director. I told him where to take it. I told him how to compose the picture. He just happened to have the telephoto lens.
Everybody wants to be a director. You know.
I know.
And I would also point out that it was taken on, I think it was the fourth orbit around the moon, not the first time they came back around the near side. And this flight captured the imagination of the world. American poet Archibald MacLeish was inspired to write and record Bubble of Blue Air.
For the first time in all of time, men have seen the Earth. Seen it not as continents or oceans from the little distance of 100 miles or 2 or 3, but seen it from the depths of space. Seen it whole and round and beautiful and small as even Dante, that first imagination of Christendom, had never dreamed of seeing it. As the 20th century philosophers of absurdity and despair were incapable of guessing that it might be seen. And seeing it so, one question came to the minds of those who looked at it. Is it inhabited, they said to each other, and laughed. And then they did not laugh. What came to their minds 100,000 miles and more into space, halfway to the moon, they put it? What came to their minds was the life on that little lonely floating planet, that tiny raft in the enormous empty night. Is it inhabited? The medieval notion of the Earth put man at the center of everything. The nuclear notion of the Earth put him nowhere, beyond the range of reason even, lost in absurdity and war. This latest notion may have other consequences. Formed as it was in the minds of heroic voyagers who were also men, it may remake our image of mankind. No longer that preposterous figure at the center. No longer that degraded and degrading victim off at the margins of reality and blind with blood. Man may at last become himself. To see the earth as it truly is, small and blue and beautiful in that eternal silence where it floats, is to see ourselves as riders on the earth together, brothers on that bright loveliness in the eternal cold, brothers who know now they are truly brothers.
The excitement of the first human flight to circle the moon remained with Jim Lovell until the day he died, a week and a half ago.
Tell me what you thought when you're... Two things. One is you're no longer connected to the earth. You can't yell help. They can't tell you what to do. You're on your own. First time you've ever been up there when that's happened, right?
Well, yes, except in Gemini when we didn't have communication. But we're 200,000 miles, 240,000 miles away.
You're 240,000 miles away from this place that's telling you what to do. Nobody's talking to you. Nobody can hear you. You're just looking at it. Uh-huh. What do you think?
We were so curious, so excited about being at the moon that we were like three school kids looking into a candy store window, watching those ancient old craters go by from, and we're only 60 miles above the surface. That we didn't have any kind of feeling, at least myself, of, you know, fear or if, you know, are we going to get back or not. It was just to be there was such an exciting moment that, you know, would have done it all the time. I felt very, very honored and lucky to be there.
That that particular Christmas, 1968, was the end of a tumultuous year, really a tumultuous time in American history. And there was a very salutary effect on this country and the world because of your flight. Did you anticipate that?
At the time, we didn't know what the effect of the flight would be. We didn't know whether the flight was going to be successful or not. But you're absolutely right. You know, with riots and assassinations and the war going on, I was part of a thing that finally gave an uplift to the American people about doing something positive, which was really, that's why I say Apollo 8 was really the high point of my space career.
There are people in NASA who will say it's the high point of NASA's career, that the landing, of course, is what you were shooting for.
Yeah.
But that proved that you could do all the things that everybody said you could do.
Yeah, I sort of lean that way. On Apollo 11, I was honored to be with Lindbergh, watching the launch from the Cape, you know, and I said to General Lindbergh, I said, isn't this really apropos? I mean, this is the most auspicious moment. These people are going to go up there and they're going to land on the moon. And Lindbergh looked at me and said, well, yes, to a certain degree. He said, but Apollo 8 was the real charger of this whole program.
How did you choose that Christmas message that you all delivered?
Good story. That Christmas message, when we determined, first of all, that we would get and burn into the lunar orbit on Christmas Eve, we thought, boy, something's got to be appropriate to say. We ought to say something. What can we say? And we couldn't think of anything. Then there was a fellow that I think Borman knew. His name was Cy Burgin. He was with the U.S. Information Agency, I think, had gone with them, some of the astronauts around on their trips. Frank asked him, could he come up with something appropriate? Well, he couldn't, but he knew another person, I think it was a newspaper man, I forget his name, that he said, okay, I'll think it over, I'll try to see what I can do. And he was working almost all night trying to think of appropriate words, and his wife came down and said, why don't you have them read something from the Bible? And they said, well, that's, you know, the New Testament. No, she says, the Old Testament. Read it from the, because, you know, this would be very appropriate. And most of the people in the world will be listening in. And most of the people in the world are not Christian. So that's how it came to pass. They said the first 10 verses of Genesis, which is really the foundation of many of the world's religions. And that's how it got started.
And you're sitting there looking as you're reading, and God created the heavens and the earth. It was without form and void, yeah. And darkness was on the, and it must have been almost mystical to your feeling.
It was, and at the same time, we had this sort of now rudimentary TV camera, black and white camera, that was pointing out the window, watching the craters go by and slowly slipping into daylight.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I remember. It was It was a marvelous time for America and the world, but a particularly marvelous Christmas time after what had been a terrible year.
Jim Lovell speaking on 1999, May the 25th, with Ron Stone, new TV reporter, at the Oral History Unit at the Johnson Space Center in Clear Lake, Houston. This is The Space Show.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Where The Space Show is celebrating the life of Jim Lovell, who died aged, I think it was 98, 97, a week and a half ago. Now, less than a month after Apollo 8 returned to Earth, poet James Dickey wrote First Manned Moon Orbit. Now, I can't find any recording of Dickey reading this poem, but I do have to hand the 1969 January the 10th issue of Life magazine. So, here is my reading. First Manned Moon Orbit by James Dickey. So long. So long as the void is hysterical, bolted out, you float on nothing. But procedure alone. Eating, sleeping like a man, deprived of the weight of his own and all humanity in the name of a new life, and through this, making new time slowly, the moon comes. Its mountains bulge, they crack and hold together, closer, spreading, smash crust of uncanny rock, ash glowing, alchemizing the sun. With peace, with the peace of a country, bombed out by the universe. You lean back from the great light-shattered face, the pale blaze of Godstone coming. Close, too close, and the dead seas turn, the craters hover, turn their dark side to kill the radio and the one voice of Earth. You and your computers have brought out the silence of mountains the animal eye has not seen since the earth split. Since God first found geometry, would move in mysterious ways. You hang, mysteriously pulling, the moon dark pulling, and solitude breaks down like an electrical system. Is it something? Else nothing is something? Something I am trying to say, O God, Almighty, to come back, to complete the curve, to come back, singing with procedure, back through the last dark of the moon, past the dim ritual random stones of oblivion, and through the blinding edge of moonlight into the sun. And behold, the blue planet steeped in its dream of reality, its calculated vision shaking with the only love. Apollo for the First Manned Moon Orbit by James Dickey. Now, 1972, Ronald Pereira set that poem to music. Retitled Apollo Circling, You Lean Back, here Gretchen de Armand to sing it, accompanied by Constance LaSalle on the piano.
Thank you. since the animal eye has not seen, since the earth split, since God first found geometry.
Gretchen Diamond with You Lean Back from the cycle Apollo Circling. And as I said, it was based on that poem by James Dickey. Well, Jim Lovell went on to work console on a number of other missions. And he was given the assignment for Apollo 13, which we're not going to cover tonight, but just as Les said, they headed out towards the moon. There was an explosion, and they made it back to Earth, thank heavens. Now, we've covered that many times here on The Space Show, including our very own interview with Fred Hayes, who was one of the astronauts on that ill-fated mission. So we say farewell to Jim. Now, with Jim gone, there are now five people still alive who have been to the moon. Let's go through them. Buzz Aldrin flew Apollo 11 and landed on the moon in 1969 on the first lunar landing mission with Neil Armstrong. He's aged 95 at the moment. Then there's Charlie Duke. He landed on the moon in 1972 and Apollo 16. He's now aged 89. Fred Hayes from Apollo 13 did the circumlunar mission in 1970. Didn't land on the moon, obviously, like Jim Lovell. And he's now aged 91. And there's Jack Smith, or Harrison Smith, and he was the geologist, the only scientist to actually travel to the moon. And he flew on Apollo 17 and landed in 1972. And Jack is aged 90 at the moment. And there's Dave Scott. He landed on the moon in 1971 on Apollo 15, and he's now aged 93. And hopefully they'll be with us for a long time yet. Now, we've got a little bit of moon music here with Bobby Darin, and I'm sure you will remember the song.
Fly me to the moon and let me play among stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other kiss me.
fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You're all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please.
Bobby Darin, wonderful singer. Now we're going to go to Jerry Woodfill. He worked the problem on Apollo 13, helped solve the... he was in the back room and he put his head together with all the others there and helped save Apollo 13. He has lots of songs about it, but we're going to go back a little further, and he has a song here about the astronaut class of 1959. You will remember that in last week's show, we told the story, well, Jim Lovell himself told the story, of how he nearly made it to the Mercury 7, in which seven astronauts were chosen as the first lot of American astronauts. So here's Jerry Woodfill.
Shepard was our first in space. Grissom was our second. Allen went to the moon. What happened to Grissom? Do you reckon? Plus, next spaceship sank, but he didn't drown. Other astronauts, Corbett, Strobe around. So Glenn came next to the orbit around. Slayton's heart problems kept him on the ground. Wally went to space on Apollo 7, but he got the flu and spoke words not from heaven. And the class of 59 had its dream. Oh, they thought they'd change the world, it seemed, with great works and deeds. Or maybe they just thought the world would change to fit their needs. Class of 59 had its dream. Carpenter got lost trying to splash down. He landed off course and could not be found. So thanks to his mislanding and Wally's loose lip, both were denied a moon trip. Cooper was a man of prayer, and so was John Glenn. But by 69, NASA to the moon would pick other men. But Shepard with his golf club, NASA chose to send the class of 59, part of history. Yes, the class of 59 is part of history. Living life day to day, never I could see. Things get complicated in spite of our best scheme, but the class of 59.
That was Jerry Whitfield, who actually worked at NASA, Johnson Space Center. Now, under United Nations agreement, you can't go and claim the moon. Remember how in the colonial days the Europeans went out and said, I claim Australia, whatever. Well, you can't do that with the moon. So there's no American moon because the Americans went and landed there. There's no Soviet or Russian moon. And, well, I don't know if the Chinese have signed that agreement or not, but there's no Chinese moon either, I guess. But there is an Irish moon. Yes, there is an Irish moon, according to Bap Kennedy.
Here's to my friend, that's Michael Collins, an Irish man, I have no doubt, at the controls. He is a genius, and he likes a drink, and it's my shout. Here's to you once more round the Irish moon. The whole world is relying now on you to bring the boys back home. Collins, as you navigate through the starry night, all by yourself on the old dark side, do not forget young John McGee. He could not dream of the things you've seen. Here's to you once more round the Irish moon. The whole world is relying now on you to bring the boys back home. And when you do, there'll be a drink for you, Michael Collins. Here's to you once more round the Irish moon. The whole world is relying now on you to bring the boys back home. And when you do, there'll be a drink for you. Once more round the Irish moon, Michael Collins, Michael Collins.
Now that I've listened to that, that makes sense. Irish moon, Michael Collins. Someone else who did not walk on the moon, although he orbited it on Apollo 11.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.